Roll 2d6, show number 3. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of Roll 2d6. I'm Adam.
And I'm Nate.
And we're here to talk about games. So thanks, first of all, to everyone who sent feedback about the second show. It seems that a lot of people liked the information we presented about gaming on the cheap, and have requested some more shows on that topic. And I'm sure that we will revisit this topic again, but not today.
No, we have to mix it up with a little bit of variety before we go back to that.
So
this week, we're going to talk about spaceship combat. It's something near and dear to many tabletop gamers' hearts, and there have been many, many games in this area. So we're going to go through a couple of them that we like, that we've played a lot, or that were otherwise influential. Now, these are just thumbnail sketches of the games. We'll probably devote some sort of show in the future to each and every one of them, but not today.
So the first game we want to mention is Star Warriors.
This was released
by West End Games back when they had the Star Wars RPG license. I don't know how many years ago that was. But this is another hex map game of Starship Fighter combat. You have little cardboard chiclets for all the various types of fighters, like the Rebel X-Wing, Y-Wing, A-Wing, B-Wing, as well as the Imperial fighters like TIE Fighters, Interceptors, TIE Bombers, Lambda-class shuttles, and things like that, or even light freighters like the Millennium Falcon.
Now, I got a real soft spot for this game because it was one of the first Starship Combat games I ever played. It was one that I had while in high school during my RPG years, and I actually got into this game and started playing it because of the RPG. It was the way
West End Games Star Wars RPG.
Yes, the West End Games Star Wars RPG. It was the way we used to determine our Starship Combat rather than using the RPG combat rules.
I'm sure that made for much more satisfying Starship Combat experience.
Oh yeah, it was. It was a lot of fun. And
rather than just rolling a dice based on your piloting skill.
Right. And the character that I had was a smuggler, and the smuggler comes with a freighter ship in the old West End Games rules, and so you had the ship, and I was able to translate my ship stats into Star Warrior ship stats and actually fly my own ship around and try to shoot things. It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. And this game, it's a sort of a flight level game. Each side usually controls a flight of fighters, which is usually around 6 to 8 ships.
Right.
And you fly around and you shoot at the other ships. It tries to capture the feel of fighter dogfighting as portrayed in the Star Wars movies.
Yeah, so it's not, you know, physics compatible, but it's just like the movies.
You can do all the airplane type quick turns and banks and things like that.
Right. One of the interesting things I like about this game is the fact that the scale is on a really minute level. It's, you know, you're in the X-Wing, you know, you have to fix your stabilizers until, you know, and have your R2 unit do, you know, backup power for you. And so there's a lot of fiddly bits on each individual fighter that you use.
That's right. There was various maneuvers you could do and various types of critical hits you could get which would affect your ability to maneuver. And you could signal your R2 unit to try to repair them and things like that.
Yeah. And this was the source of our long-standing joke around the table of double rolling and double jinking.
That's right.
Because and we'll get into that. That's an inside joke. But this is the source of the term double roll and double jink for all of our space combat today.
Okay. The second game that we want to talk about. Do you want to introduce?
Yeah, I do. It's a Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator. Now, this was FASA's Tactical Combat Simulator. It's also a hex map game with starship counters. It was back when they had their Trek license, and it was just after the Next Generation started.
That was in 1987.
Right. There you go. That's
I'm a Star Trek geek.
That's exactly. Okay. I thought I was, and I've now been I've been aced in that department. So this one came with my deluxe RPG set of FASA's Star Trek RPG, which I used to play. So I also had this one in high school. And so in essence, it was my space combat game by default for many years, because it was the one that I actually owned and had around.
Yeah, you and I have played this game a bit lately, and we both like it. I think one of the things that we like is that you have a certain amount of power management on the ship. Each ship generates a certain amount of power based on your warp engines, and you allocate that to movement, weapons, and shields.
Right.
And you also have to allocate shield points and one of the things that I thought was neat about this is that because you're on a hex map, each counter has six sides, and so you allocate shield points to the six sides of your counter.
Yes.
So that when you get hit, you have to hope that your points on the side that's facing wherever people are hitting you from.
Right, and that your facing is correct. I think the essence of this game is power management.
Yes, indeed.
If the essence of the Star Warriors game is dogfighting, the essence of Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator is power management. And I try to get that across. I ran it at Kublai Khan a couple years ago, and I tried to get that across to some of the people that were there. And that is, no, it's not, your maneuvers are not nearly as important as how you manage your power.
That's right. It's actually Scotty in the bowels of the ship that is actually.
That's right.
The most
He's the deciding
guy.
Force as to whether or not what you can do in the game. I mean, I played some other space combat games at the time when I got this one, and they were just unfun to play. So this was the one that I stuck with for a long time. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of Aerotech,
which
I played a couple times and was decidedly unfun.
Yeah,
so it's not even on this list of discussion.
I didn't like that one when I played that a couple times.
And I also didn't do... Well, okay. So, you know, that was Tactical Combat Simulator. I really like the game. It's a little complicated for power management. You sort of have to think backwards. Rather than, you know, where do I want to be? How do I want to shoot? You have to think, well, how much power is my left nacelle putting out, and where can I put that?
That's right.
So it's a little bit backwards and complicated in that way. And you had another insightful thing. Every time we play, what's our biggest beef about it?
Is that the photon torpedoes are way too powerful in this game.
Absolutely.
There's really no reason to use anything, to fire anything other than photon torpedoes.
Yeah. So
whenever we have played this recently, we limit the number of photon torpedoes. Instead of having an unlimited number, we give people a very limited number, like four or five.
Right, the power to damage ratio on the torpedoes is way out of line with the other sorts of weapons, and so
yeah. Before we had instituted that rule, I think every game consisted of flying up close to someone and unloading with torpedoes.
Yeah, and unloading a ton of torpedoes as quick as you could. Yes, that was the entire game. Now there's more substance to the game.
So the third game we want to mention is Babylon 5 Wars. And this was published by Agents of Gaming back when the show Babylon 5 was still in production. I think in 1995 is when this came out.
Right. So this isn't the current revival one. This is the Agents of Gaming version, the first one.
Yeah, this is now
old school.
And Agents of Gaming is out of business now.
Yeah.
So this is yet another hex map game with starship counters and, of course, using the ships and the factions from Babylon 5. So you have the Earth Alliance, the Narns, the Centauri, the Minbari, and all the other minor races.
8,000 minor races.
And this is also a game that has a system of per-ship power allocation. It's not quite as central to the game as it is in the Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator.
Right, and tactics and fire order and weapons use. And essentially, sometimes movement is also really important in this game versus Combat Simulator.
And the other thing we like about Babylon 5 Wars as compared to Star Warriors and Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator is that Babylon 5 Wars has an excellent system for having both large capital ships and lots of small fighters in the battle.
Right.
So you can have not just a fighter-on-fighter battle or not just a ship-on-ship battle, but you can have both in the same battle, and as was often seen in the show.
Right. My favorite bit about that is it sort of zooms out. I mean, in the way that Star Warriors was each individual pilot taking care of their ship, in Babylon 5 Wars, a flight of fighters is, you know, one hex, or, you know, one counter on a hex, and that's, you know, two to six fighters or something like that. And so you move them as a group, and it sort of zooms out a little bit from the scale of some of these other ships. And because of that, you have a wider strategic options in the game.
That's right. You can bring your big ship in, then you can launch a bunch of fighters out and try to either engage the enemy ship or engage their fighter screen.
Right.
It's very interesting. And you can do defensive fire with your ship. You can try to shoot down incoming shots, as was seen on the show. And there's a bunch of different weapon types that all deal damage in different ways to the ships. And I find that very interesting.
Right.
The movement system is something we both have a big beef with, though.
Right. This was, let me tell you, I have to admit that this used to be my least favorite Starship Combat
right.
game. I remember Nights of Torture, trying to figure out how to play this game with you and Scott.
Yes.
And I remember we played once 4 hours and did three turns, only three chances to move and fire in 4 hours.
That's right.
And I'd gone through an entire six-pack of soda. And I was still no closer to understanding or being able to play the game.
I think you used to call this the game that had all the fun of four-column accounting.
Yes, it was the game that had all the fun of four-column accounting. But I am so glad that you made me play it more than once, and you lent me the rules so that I could actually read the rules and internalize them a little bit before I played. It really isn't a good game to sit down and teach someone while playing unless you are really... unless you're devoted to the fact you're only going to get through two turns.
Yeah, it's fairly complicated to learn, but once you've... gotten it down, it's really a lot of fun, and we've developed some modified record sheets and things like that, which really simplify the game.
Right, an actual four column accounting method that simplifies the game.
It's more fun than it sounds.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm really glad about as well that has helped make this one of my favorites was using an optional user created or fan created graphical inertial movement system. It essentially simplified the major accounting that went into the previous, the original movement system, and turned it into a graphical movement system that's based on inertia, made it physics friendly and therefore more Nate friendly, and I was able to offload that information about the game onto the board, and I didn't have to keep in mind all the esoteric rules of movement.
That's right. It was a little complicated because you had PowerPoints created by your engine, and then you would take those PowerPoints and put them into a thruster, which would turn them into thrust points, and then you would have a certain number of thrust points, which would produce 1 point of acceleration.
Right.
So there was multiple levels of indirection, and with this new movement system we're using, it takes away a lot of that. It makes it a lot faster.
Right. You still have that, but you don't have to do the additional accounting of how often can I do one hex face turning in order to move.
And exactly.
It was needlessly complicated, I think, under the old system. They were trying to simulate inertial movement without having to teach people about what vectors are.
That's right. And once you actually introduce vectors into the game, it doesn't add that much complexity, but it makes the movement much more conceptually easy to understand, I think.
Right.
And one of the things that I like about this game also is that there's still a lot of people on the net that talk about it and play it, and people have taken the Babylon 5 Wars game system and made all kinds of non-Babylon 5 ships in this system.
Yes, they
created stats for all the Star Trek ships from the original series all the way up to Next
Battlestar
Generation
Galactica,
and movies, Battlestar Galactica,
you name it,
Dune, Stargate, Star Wars,
Space,
all kinds of things.
Space 1999 or something.
People have created all kinds of crazy ships. So we actually, the last few games of Babylon 5 Wars we have played, we've played Star Trek ships with Star Trek-style hard shields, and we use that in the Babylon 5 Wars system. That's a lot of fun.
It is, and I want to say that I think I like it better than Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator in that way, and that it's more of a tactical game in that point rather than merely the power management game that Tactical Combat Simulator becomes.
Yeah, and it becomes more interesting, and it's more than just fly up to someone and shoot them with torpedoes.
And unload a bunch of torpedoes at them, yes.
And
so the last one that we want to talk about is, well, Starfleet Battles. I didn't really want to talk about Starfleet Battles because I'm a big enough Star Trek purist to not want to get into Starfleet Battles because of its weird alternate reality license.
It's alternate fictional reality.
Right, and then it's Trek, but it's not Trek, and they can't say that it's Trek, and yet they can. I just don't understand it. I don't like it.
They have some kind of weird license that they got back in the 60s, so they have...
like in perpetuity. It's like for some reason the regular license can float around, but Starfleet Battles maintains theirs. And, you know, and I know that people are just going to write in and say, hey, you didn't mention Starfleet Battles. Well, now we've mentioned it.
Yes.
Don't write in.
Neither one of us play it, and I don't think either one of us ever have played it.
And I'm honestly not incredibly interested in starting.
I would play it. But
well.
But I won't.
Okay,
I won't,
if you bought
you it,
you
it
learned
me.
It. You thank you. That'll be fine. That works for everybody.
I just happen to never have played it. So anyway, don't write in and tell us we forgot it because we didn't.
And so what we're going to talk about today is we're going to zoom in on the scale. We talked about Babylon 5 Wars being a sort of a larger scale game, Tax Simulator a little bit narrower, and Star Warriors very narrow. Here we're going to get into the two games that we're going to talk about today are none of these, but they go even further. They go, what happens between the bulkheads?
That's right. What happens when the people inside your ship are running around from place to place trying to do their job and... make your ship win the battle. So one of these is an old game, and one of them is a relatively new game. I shouldn't say old game. It's a classic game.
It's a classic game. It's just been around for 20-plus years. That's not old. That's classic.
That's classic. So first, Nate is going to talk about the classic game The Awful Green Things from Outer Space.
Awful Green Things. I love that title.
And then I will talk about a new game came out just last year, which is called Battle Stations.
No, it's Battle Stations!
That's right. It has an exclamation point at the end, so it's right. A very exciting game.
So all of you that are suckers for games with exclamation points, you just have to buy it anyway. All right, so on to Awful Green Things.
Awful Green Things from Outer Space.
Fighting monsters shoulder to shoulder, Awful Green Things from Outer Space. It's an older game that's been around forever. It was originally written by Tom Wham, author of Snitz Revenge and others.
And I love Snitz Revenge.
I know you do. It was on your top 10 most influential games from our first episode. And the current version of Awful Green Things is developed by Steve Jackson Games. And I love Evil Stevie's stuff, and I love what he's done with the game.
This was originally published by TSR, and they decided they didn't want it anymore, and so the rights actually reverted back to Tom Wham.
Right.
And he was approached by Steve Jackson to republish it.
Yeah, and so now they're in their seventh edition. The first one was a Dragon magazine insert, and then there were a couple of TSR editions, and now there have been four Steve Jackson game editions.
And that first one was, I think, in 1979, wasn't it?
Yes.
Quite a while ago.
It was. I mean, like I said, it's been around forever.
It's a classic.
Yeah, there you go. It's a classic game. And, you know, as the editions have gone out, the game itself was expanded. If you compare the game from the Dragon magazine insert to the current video box version from Steve Jackson Games, you'll see a very different expanded game. They added, you know, expanded weapon capability, moving outside the ship. And, well, we'll get into exactly what the game consists of now. So if you're a completist and you want to collect all of them, I'm sure you could go out and collect every single version if you wanted to, but let's focus on the...
That would be a lot of different versions.
That's right, the latest version. So the game itself is very simple. It's like the half the alien movies you've ever seen. The crew of the ship versus the aliens. The aliens, they get tougher and they reproduce quickly, and the crew are resourceful and they find things around the ship to try to fight the awful green things.
So the premise of the game is that the crew has been exploring somewhere and these aliens,
yes,
these awful green things have invaded their ship, and the game begins right at the point where the aliens have expanded a bit and the crew have just stumbled upon them for the first time.
Right.
And realized, hey, there's all these things on our ship. We have to kill them.
Right. The mighty starship Znutar has finally discovered its alien infestation, and then they run around the ship and try to kill each other for the rest of the game. But you don't know exactly... Now, the crew tries to find the makeshift weapons that are through the game, but they don't know exactly how they react to the awful green things. So you have... If someone tries to shoot it with a laser, you draw a weapon effects chip, and you look at it, and it tells you what the laser does to the awful green thing. And the best part about this is the weapons have their own... They do something against the crew that you know, like the laser will do a certain amount of damage to the crew, and you know that, but then when you pull the weapon effects against the green thing, it could be damage, it could be stun, it could make them reproduce, it could make them grow. There are lots of different effects. So the game replays differently every time. If you sat and played it twice in a row, the different weapons and the different strategy you'd use would be slightly different because of the random... the randomness of the makeshift weapons.
I think that's the most fun way about it is, you know, as you're trying to fight off these aliens, you don't know what of all the various weapons on your ship is going to actually be effective.
Right.
And sometimes it'll be something really good, like maybe the fire extinguisher, which lets you fill a whole room with a weapon effect. Or it might be something really kind of useless like the syringe,
right,
which is something you can only use in hand-to-hand combat and only use against one single alien.
Right. And then there are some weapons that can be used, or the makeshift weapons that replenish themselves. Like you can always go get a new can of Zgwort, which is essentially like spam or something for the you know, this canned food product for the aliens or for the crew. And you can always go get another one out of the kitchen if you want. But then there are other ones that once they're used, they're gone. Like some of the grenades.
Yeah, that's true. Some of the weapons are used once, and some of them are some one item which people can carry around, and there's others which you have basically an infinite amount of.
Right. So all in all, it's kind of a light game. I mean, all the different characters, both the crew and the aliens, have their stats right there on their little chits, their little cardboard counters, and the math is pretty easy. and the rolling is pretty easy, and it was fun. From the very first time I played it, I had a lot of fun with it, and I enjoyed the replay value of trying to find out new strategies and new and interesting things to do with the weapons when they came up.
That's right, and it also plays quite a bit differently if you're playing the crew versus if you're playing the green things.
Absolutely.
And as the crew, you have a lot of challenges trying to fight off the green things, trying to grab the various weapons, trying to test them in an isolated way so that you don't accidentally fragment the green things into multiple green things.
Right.
And as the green things, you have a much simpler strategy, but you still have other various ways to go about it, and you have to try to not get hit by any of those strategies.
Right, right. It ends up playing as a different game depending on whether or not you're the crew or the green things. And I really like that. It has a good solid replay value that way. And everybody that I know that or even heard of that plays the game has some fixes for the game, fixes and customizations for the game.
There's quite a few variants out there.
Yes. One of the things that almost without exception I have seen is people remaking the map of the ship, of the Zenutar, larger, so there's more room for the cardboard counters on there. Because as it is, there's no way. I mean, there's no stacking limit on these. You could stack them up all you want, but you still want to know how many of the green things you have in one particular room, and so you want to be able to see all those counters, and the map that's included just doesn't fit the counters very well. So everyone that I know that I've seen it been played, somebody has made a larger version of the map.
I agree, and I've done that myself with my copy of Awful Green Things. I have the latest Steve Jackson version in the video box, and the map is not large enough. There's certain rooms in the map, like the central hallway, that turn out to always be chock full of counters, and when you've got 15 counters in there, there's really not enough room on the map. So I did draw a larger one on a large sheet of paper, and that I'd like to play on that one instead.
Right. One of the other customizations I've seen people do is reinforcing the cardboard counters. Sometimes a little bit of extra cardboard backing or felt or wood, something to make them easier to pick up. Because when you've got all these really thin, it's a fairly thin cardboard counter all over, trying to get your fingernail underneath it on top of the map without accidentally moving other counters or accidentally sneezing and sending the entire crew of the Zenutar off into space. So I've seen some, and I even saw
in Board Game Geek, we used to call that the deadly sneeze.
Yeah, the deadly sneeze. I even saw on Board Game Geek somebody put wood backing on the backside of all of their on the backside of that, so that they'd have something nice and thick that they could pick up and hold on to.
Especially if you've made a larger map, you may as well make nice larger counters.
Right.
So we can get the exact same crowding problems.
That's right. Well, actually, I want to talk about a game that I played where they had a map that was literally like 5 feet long, but they also blew up the counters proportionally. So we still had the same crowding problem, but it was on this enormous map. And it was incredibly crowded, and I thought, why didn't you guys just leave the counters smaller so we didn't have any problems? But they didn't think of that.
I think the best way to do it is make the map like twice as big and then make the counters 50% bigger.
There you go.
So you still end up with things bigger, but it's a little more room.
There you go. That's probably a good way to do it. One of the other fixes or customizations I've seen are expansions. Since the very beginning of the game has been under heavy expansion. Steve Jackson incorporated a lot of those expansions into his edition.
Yeah, that's true. When you buy the current Steve Jackson Games edition, you won't even realize that there have been expansions because they're all right there in the rules.
Yes, they've all been incorporated.
Here's the standard rules.
As a matter of fact, on Steve Jackson Games' homepage for Awful Green Things from Outer Space, there are further sets of unofficial rule expansions that he links to that give new alien types, new weapon effects, new weapons, and rules for doing different play types, like doing a blind game or a double blind game.
I would love to play a double blind version of Awful
Green
Things.
I think it would be great.
I think it would take a really long time, but I think it would be fun.
Yeah.
It would add a whole new dimension because, especially as the crew, you'd have to sort of really sneak through your ship and try to find the green things instead of just knowing where they are.
Just knowing that they happen to be in the communications room. Let's go get them, sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah. And the last customization that I've seen is a faster setup. The setup rules for the starting position of all the counters are a little lengthy. Sometimes, I mean, they take a fair amount of time to get everybody distributed how they need to be distributed.
It does take a while.
And because some of the choices that you're allowed to make, people can sit there and stew on the choices forever. And so sometimes there's, people have come together with a standardized, placing of the pieces so you don't have to make any decisions.
I had not heard about that. We should try that next time we play.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'll tell you my war story about Awful Green Things from Outer Space and why I haven't played it for about a year. well, I haven't offered to play it with you or anything for about a year. I got sick of it from Gen Con SoCal.
This was at Gen Con SoCal of 2004, right?
Oh, yes.
Last December?
Yeah. Wait, okay. No, it was a year before last December, so I guess it's been a year and a half, yeah. So I went to Gen Con SoCal. You were there.
I was there.
And I went hoping to just to play a round or two. I wasn't, thinking of spending all day there. And it was us and a couple of friends, and we were there, and I said, I'd like to play. And so I found out that this was actually an elimination tournament. And I thought, okay, that's fine. Somebody's going to beat me.
Awful Green Things tournament.
Yeah, it was an Awful Green Things tournament. And I thought, well, okay, I'll play for a couple rounds, and then I'll be able to go off. And so I was playing, and my first game was with another friend of mine, Joey. Hey, Joey, I know you're listening. So Joe was playing with me. It was his first time playing. So the first round was, was me sort of teaching him how to play, and by luck I won. I wasn't trying really hard, but I won, and he got bumped out of the tournament, and I moved up to the next rung. Now, as I kept going, by luck and choice, I was the crew in every round, and I stumbled upon a strategy that worked. And it worked every time, and I was able to go up, three or four rungs up the ladder using this same strategy. And this, by the way, when I say strategy, I mean that loosely, because this depends on a couple major pieces of luck falling into place.
I think you managed to get that piece of luck in every one of your
games.
Yes,
but I did. I managed to get it in every one of the games, so that's why I'm calling it a strategy. So here's the strategy that I found. If you're the crew, you need two things. You need an area effect stun weapon, and you need several fragmentation weapons. The fragmentation weapons are not a big problem because there are four out of the 15 weapon effects are fragmentation effects. So having a couple different weapons that do fragmentation isn't that hard. The stun, there's only, I believe, one area effect or only one stun effect for a weapon, and you have to hope that stun effect lands on something that's area effect. In some games,
there's only three or four area effect weapons, I think,
right,
out of the 15 or so weapons.
Yeah, out of the 15 or so weapons, there are like three that I can think of right off the top. There's the comm beamer, the rocket fuel, and the fire extinguisher.
And there's also the smoke grenade.
Oh, the smoke grenade. All right, there you go.
And the electric fence is area effect, too, but you have to have that set up ahead of time.
Yeah, the electric fence you can't just deploy immediately. Anyway, so you need an area effect stun weapon and several fragmentations. So you try to draw the areas into a confined space, and I always manage to make it be the center hallway. It has some good tactical reasons why the center hallway is a good place for this. And so you fragment them the best you can with the fragmentation weapons. You try to get them all fragmented. And then you use the area effect stun on the fragments to keep them from growing. Every round in this game, the aliens grow one level. They go from fragments to eggs to babies to adults. And then once they're adults, when they grow, they actually just lay more eggs. And so you keep them stunned so they can't grow. And you repeat drawing them into the confined space and fragmenting them until you have all the fragment pieces out on the board.
And there are only 22 fragment counters in the game, and this is very important.
Right, there are 22 fragment counters in the game, and every time you hit with a fragment weapon, it's 1d6 fragments per alien that was hit. And so you can use those up really fast if you get four or five aliens in there. Most likely, if you end up getting six aliens of any size in there, you'll have all the fragment chips out there. If you have an area effect fragmentation weapon, this is, you can do something better and let them grow to be babies first and then fragment them, and this speeds up this process of getting all the fragment chips out on the board. Once all the fragment chips are out on the board, you evoke rules clarification number 2 from the online FAQ, which reads essentially that any additional fragmentation targets, are removed if all 22 fragments are in play. So if you have in this hallway a bunch of fragments of awful green things that are stunned and unable to get up because you keep area effect stunning them with the area effect stun weapons, then anything else that your other fragmentation weapons do anywhere else in the ship removes the target from the board. So it becomes a one-shot instant kill for all these other weapons that used to be labeled just fragment weapons.
So instead of actually fragmenting the target, we would just remove it.
Right.
Or instead of having no effect, you would just remove it and
Right. And that, this is, yeah this
that,
is
that
in the,
makes, suddenly makes those much more powerful.
Right. In the official rules clarification, this now turns the 4 out of 15 fragmenting weapons into 4 out of 15 one-shot instant kill, remove the alien from the board weapons.
But only if you have all the other 22 fragments already in play.
Right, exactly. If you can't keep the other 22 out on the board and stunned, then this doesn't help you at all. So this is why you need the area effect stun weapon. That's in one of my games, I actually think I had an area effect stun weapon. I think I had three different kinds. I had the comm beamer, which has an area effect. I had the fire extinguisher, and I also had the rocket fuel. Now, the rocket fuel also kills your own crew member, so there were times when I had to, you know, stun all the fragments before they grew, but I couldn't get a crew member out of the hull in time, and he had to take one for the team and die in a blaze of rocket fuel while it was fragmenting the aliens. But, of course, I'm the captain. That's my job to make those decisions.
So, I think we need a mutiny rule.
That's a mutiny rule. After the captain kills so many crew in his vain attempts. No. And so now you just go around and you kill everything else in the ship. You send out the rest of your guys, if there are any left, with the fragmentation weapons to go essentially eliminate all the rest of the aliens from the board. So now you're stuck with a room full of sleeping fragments to try to mop up. Now, fragments are the weakest of the alien types, and so pretty much any regular kill weapon or even hand-to-hand combat can kill them. And so you just have to start killing them one by one, and you apply damage effects before the stun effects, so if you don't kill the weak fragment, that's okay. Chances are they'll be stunned when the area effect stun effect happens. And so I was able to use this strategy for three different levels in this tournament and got all the way to the semifinals using this exact same thing. And by that time, it was now evening, and I had spent most of my day playing awful green things.
How many games were there you played in total that day?
Oh, it was... It was like double elimination for each ladder, so I think I ended up playing like seven, or I forget what it was, but I ended up playing like seven games, and it was, you know, and finally dinner time by the time we were done.
And that last game took like most of that time, right?
It did. The last one took a long time.
Wasn't
because
2 or 3 hours?
Yeah, it took an incredibly long time because the guy wouldn't give up. I just kept I was doing the strategy, and he kept saying, "Oh, but there's an infinitesimal chance that one of my fragments will not be stunned," and so I actually had to do all the roll for every fragment. And
I think it was because fragments have a strength of 6, I think, right?
Right.
So it was the chance of rolling 5 ones on 5 dice,
right?
That one of them would wake up.
Exactly. So I'd just roll. You know, and so I had to roll 5 dice every time, and if I got, you know, 5 ones, then there was a chance that, you know, it would wake up, and it never happened. But he was intent that there was a chance, and that he was going to make me stick it out for all of those rather than just concede and know that the slow mopping up was going to happen. So I got into the semifinals, and I was now in the semifinals, and there was going to be, you know, a final one against the other guy. And I asked if there was a prize for second place, and they said yes, and I took it, and I conceded the final game because I wanted to do something else at Gen Con rather than just play Awful Green Things. So for a year and a half, I've not played Awful Green Things from Outer Space. Because
and I think for like 2 to 3 days after that, you still saw the Znutar in your
yes,
head
in my
every
dreams,
time you closed
and in my
your
head,
eyes.
I closed my eyes, I would see the outline of the ship. It was just horrible. It was the same thing that happened to me with Tetris when I played Tetris for 2 days straight once. With Tetris, I was constantly seeing blocks falling from the sky, and in this, I was just always saw this spaceship, and so I was really not interested in this game anymore. I think I'm over that now. I haven't had any nightmares about this new Znutar.
We should try playing it again and see
we
if
should.
The nightmares
we
come
should.
Back.
And this time, I insist on being the aliens.
You can be the green things.
So I don't accidentally run across the the same strategy and mop up the floor with you.
And I think the only reason they put that rule in is because... Well, obviously, one reason just so that you don't end up with infinite numbers of fragments.
Right, right.
Because if you
fragment fragments, then you
yeah.
Then you have
you can
have
end
this
up
expanding
with,
geometric effect. Of,
yeah, at which point you would never be able to win the game.
Right, right.
Once you had 200 fragments on board.
Right.
But yeah, that does make that. A lot of things have to fall into place for this strategy to work. Right.
Right.
You have to get that area effect stun weapon.
Right.
You have to get some good fragmenting weapons. You have to do, and even just finding those weapons soon enough in the game that you can actually use them.
Yes, because you have to test them all out and find out what they do before you can even...
Because the aliens are slowly whittling down your crew.
Right.
This is one of the interesting things, is that the aliens, there's fewer of them to start with, but they can regenerate themselves and reproduce.
Right.
The crew, you have a whole lot of them to start with, but there's no more.
Right. That's the end. They get eaten, then that's the end. As a matter of fact, when the aliens eat one of your crew members, then the aliens reproduce, and so... Every time that you lose a guy, essentially the awful green things gain a guy.
Yes, that's right. So you have to get all this stuff, and you have to get it early enough when you still have enough other crew available to carry out the rest of the strategy of hunting down the rest of the aliens.
Right.
Or having enough to ferry rocket fuel from one side of the ship to the other.
Right.
Or what have you.
Yeah, and that's actually exactly what I had to do. I had to have two guys. I had enough crew. Luckily, I had enough crew to ferry rocket fuel from the motors on the engine, the rocket engines on the ship, all the way into the hallway where I needed it. And because of the amount of time it would take, I had to have two guys running in opposite shifts so that every turn I always had an option to throw down the area effect rocket fuel stun. And if either one of those guys had been killed or had, you know, been taken out by some awful green thing that had come some other way through the ship and gotten him, then it would have ruined my tactics.
That hallway was very well blackened by the time you were done.
It was.
After many, many canisters of exploding rocket fuel.
That's right. So this is awful green things. It's you know, crew members fighting shoulder to shoulder against the green menace, and... on the show notes, we'll have links to Tom Wham's homepage. You can look at some of his, you know, games that he, you know, that he created. Also, the awful green things from outer space main page at The Geek, at Board Game Geek, and a review, and even the URL to the rule that won me the tournament, or rather, got me to second place in the tournament, at which point I quit.
All right, that's awful green things.
Awful green things.
Battle stations.
So, I'd like to talk about battle stations. And that's
battle stations!
Battle stations with an exclamation point, so you know it's going to be exciting.
That's right. It says so right in the box.
As opposed to Awful Green Things, which has been out for quite a while, this is a very new game. It came out in June of 2004 from Guerrilla Games, and I actually bought my copy last Memorial Day weekend at KublaCon 2005 after I saw a demo in the open gaming area. It looked really cool. Let me give a little overview of the game.
You were very excited, by the way, after you had that demo. You came over and you said, I just played this cool game, and I bought it. Wow, you must have really liked it. Just buy it after playing it.
I think it was that extra exclamation point that sold me.
That could have been it.
Just let me tell you, note to anyone, any future marketing person, more exclamation points equals more sales.
That's right.
So let me describe the game. The game describes itself as they call it a character-based board game of Starship Adventure. And this is kind of you can either see it as a cooperative board game or sort of a lightweight RPG. It can go in both ways.
You can either have a lot invested in the individual people, because you're controlling individual people on the ship. You can have a lot invested in their personality and do it like an RPG, or you could use them as, you know, stat tokens. It's like this, you know, this guy has a, you know, certain level of engineering, so I move my engineering token over there.
Exactly. So usually the way it's played is that all the players are crew members on one ship, and they're trying to defeat some threat or carry out some mission. And then you'll have one other person who's going to be the referee or the game master. And the game master will control any enemy ships you run into or space monsters or whatever, and the players will run around inside their own ship. And I say run around because, unlike other Starship combat games like the ones we discussed in the intro, a major part of the gameplay is what's going on inside your ship as well as outside the ship.
It actually matters how the ship is laid out on the inside, because you've got to actually move your pieces or your characters from one room to another in order for them to do, you know, Starship functions.
That's right. So before I get to that, let me talk a little bit about the premise of the game. And as described in the books, it takes place in a sort of a sci-fi future a few hundred years from now. After faster-than-light travel is perfected, humans have spread out, and they have lots of other colonies on other planets. And over the years, humans have discovered several other alien races, and a number of them have banded together to form the Universal Republic. And the aliens that they came up with for this game are, I really like them because they are very alien.
Yes,
none of them are humanoids with bumpy foreheads.
No pointy-eared humans, no...
That's right, they are all very strange, and I'll describe them a little bit later.
I think the closest one to human beings is something like a trilateral cockroach.
Yes,
if that gives you an idea of how close to humanoid these aliens are.
There's a three-legged race of three-legged, four-foot-tall cockroaches with three arms, and those are the closest thing to being humanoid.
That's right.
So the PCs, the players, are all going to be members of the UREF, the UREF, which is the United Republic Expeditionary Forces, and this is the military wing of the United Republic. And they're all crew members on the same ship with military ranks, and the GM is going to assign them a mission given to them by their superior officers, and they'll attempt to carry it out. And the descriptions of the game world and everything in the book, it's very lighthearted in tone. There's a lot of sci-fi themes, and anyone familiar with sci-fi B-movies, Star Trek, Star Wars, Futurama, any other space opera will find a lot of things that you recognize. There's a lot of comedy, and when we play this game, at least, Futurama, I think, is the main thing in our mind, as well as
absolutely.
Some of the cheesier episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah, when I first started, I couldn't help but to do it my own really bad Zap Brannigan impersonation with a couple of these things, because it was just so much like Futurama in my head. No, it's not like they weren't ripping off the franchise. I'm not saying
no,
that.
No, of course not.
But just the idea of having this really light, funny, science fiction future with some very odd things about it was really interesting.
That's right. I think your character was sort of a six-armed Zap Brannigan.
Yes.
So let me talk about the characters in the game. Each of the players has to have a character, and the game, and I think the designers recommend one character per player. But these characters are not very complex. They're not as complex as like a D&D character is. And if your group doesn't want to lean too far towards the role-playing side, you could easily do two or more characters per player.
Yeah, our group, we like to do the tabletop and the board games more than the RPGs these days, so I think we all took care of two or three characters.
Yeah, our first game, we had one referee and three players, and each of the three players controlled two characters. So we had a total crew of six, plus two robots, so we had a crew of eight. So there's six alien races, or six races, I should say, that the characters can be. You can be a human, Kenosian, which are sort of like big tumbleweeds with tentacles, Zaloxians, which are floating six-armed things, Silicoids, which are sort of rock creatures, Tentacs, which are piles of pink tentacles.
Yes, piles of pink, like a plate of spaghetti.
Plate of
but
spaghetti.
Alive.
And the Zoalans, which are the aforementioned three-legged, four-foot-tall cockroaches. And each of these has certain special abilities, and they have different movement rates. And one of the most important things is each of them has a different number of hands. And this comes into play because as your characters move around, you have to keep track of what they're carrying in their hand if they want to do an action using some piece of equipment. Humans, of course, have two hands, but Silicoids only have one, Zoalans have three, Zaloxians have six, and Kenosians and Tentacs have essentially infinite hands.
As many as they want.
Everything they have, they are carrying in a hand. And this becomes important when you characters are carrying some equipment and you want to use it. You have to get it into one of your hands.
Right.
The characters each have five attributes, which are combat, piloting, engineering, science, and athletics. And you can tell these are very utilitarian. We don't care about their intelligence or dexterity or charisma. You know,
that's right.
It's all based on the various
jobs. No charisma
bonus.
I don't get followers. And
No. But it's all based on the jobs you can do on your ship. And athletics is just sort of a general strength.
How physically fit
physically
you
fit you are, yes. And you also have a rank attribute, of course, which is sort of like your level in D&D. The characters all start out at rank one, which is ensign.
Right, and within the game itself, they actually correspond to military ranks within the UREF.
Yeah, if you go to rank two, that's your lieutenant junior grade, and you go up from there.
Right.
And then you also have the all-important luck attribute, which is a number of points you can use to make rerolls during the game. There's four professions you can have as a character, which are marine, pilot, engineer, and scientist, and you can probably guess that each of those professions directly correlates with one of the attributes, combat, piloting, engineering, and science. And then they have a list of sci-fi equipment you can buy for your character, standard sci-fi things like blast pistols, body armor. You can also get amp grenades, disintegrators, energy blades, which are similar to lightsabers, med kits, and there's even rules for cyberware. And
so I can become more machine than man, twisted and evil.
you indeed could.
All right.
So that's the characters. Let me go over one of the things that makes the game the most fun, which is the ships. Now, in this game, the ships that you're dealing with in this game, for the most part, well, in every case, I think, they're not tiny fighters, although there are some rules for that. There's not behemoth battleships. These are going to be small single-deck ships, similar to the size of maybe like the Millennium Falcon, or maybe 2-3 times bigger. Small enough that if you were starting on one end of the ship, you could walk to the other end in a couple of minutes.
All right.
And there's no turbo lifts.
And you'll have to.
That's right.
During the game, you'll have to walk from one end to the other.
The PCs are all assigned to the same ship. And one of the neat things is that the ships, when you are using a ship in a game, you have to create the layout of the ship on the table. And the ships are built out of these square modular tiles, which you lay out and you form the layout of the ship. You have a helm module, which you'll put in one section. You'll have some life support modules, which are like hallways. And you'll have gun modules and engine modules. And you'd lay them all out. And on each module is a grid of tiles, which your characters are going to move through the grid, just like moving spaces on a board. And this is a lot of fun because as the game goes on, and if your ship wants to fire a gun at another ship, you have to have one of the characters on the ship standing in that gun module, right, and using the battle station, the titular battle station, right, of that module.
The battle station!
To fire the gun at the other ship. If you want to your ship to turn or to accelerate, you have to have a pilot who's sitting in the helm module, and he's going to do a piloting action and try to turn the ship. And as things happen throughout the game, some players might get injured, some modules might get damaged, and your players end up running all across the ship from one end to the other, trying to get from one to another battle station to do something, or trying to go and run across and repair one of the modules that got damaged.
So there's all sorts of scrambling about to perform the things that would happen on a larger scale, like turning the ship and firing. You have your characters running around in the smaller scale of the ship trying to get to each area to actually accomplish those things. And as the game progresses, it becomes more and more difficult to do everything you need to do all at the same time because you have the limitation of people running around the ship and they've got to get from the gun to the engine to the science bay to the gun to the...
That's right.
Back and forth.
Just imagine there was the scene in Star Wars, I think, where they were trying to flee in the Millennium Falcon and they were under attack.
Right.
Right, and they were... And Han Solo and Chewbacca and everyone, they were running around to the ship trying to do repairs and trying to fight off the enemy. Now imagine them doing all that, but with just Han Solo and Chewie trying to do all those things.
To do everything at the same time.
That's what this game is all about. More stuff than you have people to do it.
Yes.
And having your guys run around the ship.
I have noticed that. With the ship rules, you know, there are certain life support modules, and the number of life support modules determines how many members of the crew you can have on the ship. And for whatever size the ship is, there never seem to be enough life support modules to fully staff the ship. It's not like you have one guy at every battle station. You have one guy for every 2 to 3 battle stations.
That's right. I think the UREF is having some staffing issues.
And yeah, they're not getting as many people signing up as they had before.
That's right. And when you create the ship, because there are rules for creating custom ships as well as using the standard layouts, you can actually add more life support modules to your ship. You have to have one life support module for every 4 crew. But if you do that, you are going to remove some other module that could actually do something useful, like provide engine power or be a gun or be a teleporter unit.
So then you have more people than you have stuff for them to do. If you start to monkey with a little bit, then you have lots of people standing around not able to do anything, and your ship unable to do everything that it could possibly do because you've traded in, say, your missile bay or your gun, your front gun, for another crew module.
That's right.
So learn to live with the fact that you're always understaffed.
That's right. Well, that's part of the fun of the game is that you're running around, your guys are running around the ship trying to get done everything that they're trying to do. Now, not only that, you know, your ship is getting hit by cannons and missiles from the enemy, and your guys are running around. You have, as well as the ship layout, which you'll have your ship layout, and then there'll be the enemy ship layout made up of these modular tiles. You also have a hex grid which will be on the board maybe between those two. And on the hex grid, you have a counter for the ships. And this is where you step back a level and it becomes more like a regular Starship Combat game with your ship on a hex grid trying to maneuver around and shoot at the other ship. But everything that you want to do with that ship, fire a gun or turn the ship, like I was saying, requires guys to run around your ship and be in the right spot at the right time.
Right.
And do a successful action check.
I remember in one of these games we wanted to bring the ship around and fire because of the fire rate of the weapons. We had one on the port side, one on the starboard side, and the pilot tried to bring the starboard side around so that we could fire with the starboard gun, but no one was there at the battle station in time to fire it because they were still trying to cross the ship to get over to the starboard gun.
That's right. They were still trying to run across the ship and through all the other modules that were in
between.
Through
the damaged modules that slowed them up and all sorts of other things.
So as your characters are running around the ship trying to get to a battle station to do some action, they have to do a skill check in order to actually accomplish any of these actions. And the way they do the skill checks in this game is kind of interesting. As I said before, each of the character has an attribute like combat, piloting, engineering. And in order to use one of the battle stations, they're color-coded along with the attributes. So in order to use a battle station, you have to try to use the attribute that matches that battle station. So to use an engineering station, you have to use your engineering attribute, obviously.
Right.
Or to fire a gun, you use your combat attribute. So in order to fire a weapon, there's a skill check. All the skill checks are on 2d6, and it's usually a number like 8 or 11 that you have to roll, which seems pretty difficult. But if you're using a battle station that matches your profession, like if you're a Marine trying to use a combat battle station, you get what's called a professional reroll. So what you can roll 2d6, and if you don't make the number, you can re-roll one of those two dice.
Right, you pick it out, and chances are you'll pick your lowest die.
That's
right.
And
you'll try to re-roll it, hoping to get something higher and beat the rather steep target numbers.
That's right, and so it means rolling an 8, if you have two dice with a professional re-roll, is actually pretty simple, and rolling an 11 is still a little more complicated, but not as hard as rolling it on a straight 2d6 roll. You can also use your luck points to spend those for rerolls. So if you have 5 luck points, you can use those to make 5 rerolls during the game, and those come in very handy. Usually you end up spending nearly all of them throughout
the
game.
Burn them completely, you know.
Now I mentioned that you're fighting one ship to another ship usually, or a ship against a star base, something like that. But there's also another significant component, which is boarding actions.
This is my favorite part.
So not only is your ship getting damaged, cannon shots are coming in, missiles are coming in, you're trying to fire back, you're trying to repair that damage, but the enemy ship has many different ways to get soldiers onto your ship and try to board it. They can beam over in their teleporter. They can try to get into a boarding missile, which is kind of like a breaching pod.
Right. I love the visual of this, by the way, loading up Marines into like a large torpedo and firing them into the side of a ship and having it, you know, lodge itself in the hull and then have the Marines pop out on the inside. I think is a really great visual.
That's right. And so when you're in your ship, you see a missile coming at you. You can't really tell if it's a...
Is it going to explode or are Marines going to come out of it once it hits?
So that's another little thing to get nervous about. They can also get into a fighter. They can fly that over and try to either land in your fighter bay or try to actually crash it into your ship like a breaching pod. Or they could try, if they manage to get their ship close enough to yours, try to force a dock with your ship by using their tractor beam. And so at any rate, you're not going to get through this game without having some boarding actions, either the enemy boarding your ship or you boarding the enemy ship.
Right.
And so it's often the case in this game, and this makes it a lot of fun, where you're maneuvering and trying to fight on the hex grid map with ship to ship, and at the same time trying to fight off boarders on your own ship, or trying to board the enemy ship and attack their crew. And you can even, when you're on the enemy ship, try to access their battle stations and execute ship actions on their ship.
Right, and screw them up in what they're trying to do in the larger...
That's right.
The larger map.
So it's a lot of fun, and we've played this a few times now, and it's...
Absolutely.
It's been a lot of fun. I think we're going to definitely keep playing it.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there's a few different ways to play this, depending on what kind of game group you have. And like any good system, this game becomes a framework, which you can use for lots of different things. Now, if your group leans more towards RPGs, then you use one character per player, and you emphasize the role-playing aspects. You know, you ham up the space opera, have the crew accept a heroic mission, use a mission... There's several missions in the game book that you can do, and you could use one of the missions which emphasizes more espionage and subterfuge.
Right.
So the characters, in fact, one of the last missions he did was like that, where the crew was trying to infiltrate a rebel starbase and plant bombs on it so that they could remotely blow them up later.
Right,
and
so we had to have character interaction between the characters we were controlling and the GMs, the NPC characters there on the ship, and trying to have opposed roles to see could we bluff our way past the guards and so forth.
That's right, and so I was the GM in that game, and so the crew decided to disguise themselves as a supply crew delivering additional engineering toolkits to the station. And they also had a giant bomb they were trying to plant, which yes. was disguised as a new frozen yogurt machine.
Because everyone loves frozen yogurt.
Even in the future, they love frozen yogurt.
And they'd let anybody deliver a frozen yogurt machine.
That's right. So this was a lot of fun. I had the players actually act out what they were saying to each guard as they made their way through the starbase, and then gave them some modifiers to their role based on how well they did. And so that was a lot of fun. But if your group is less an RPG group and more a board game group, you can use more than one character per player and treat it as a complex tactical board game. And this is also a lot of fun. Set up a mission which is a ship-on-ship battle with boarding actions, or some mission where you have to invade a starbase or something, and you have lots of good tactical strategic action. Or you can mix and match them both. I've often found that putting a little bit of one into the other tastes great together.
That's right. Hey, you've got your RPG in my war game.
You got your war game in my RPG.
And two great tastes that taste great together.
So that's a lot of fun. And
it is.
One other thing, do you need a GM, a referee, to play this game? Some people only have two players to play. Can you still play? I don't know if you could play it in its most normal form. You could do a one-on-one starship battle, some sort of scenario like that, and that still works perfectly fine. In fact, someone just published on the Battle Stations mailing list some good rules for doing that. But I think the best sessions of this game are ones in which you have a GM, so that there can be hidden information that the players don't have, that they have to figure out as the game unfolds.
Absolutely. Battle Stations is one of the games. I'm glad you introduced us to it and that you played it at the con, because it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun, poring over the ship schematics and trying to figure out how to make the best ship out of the modules. And it was also a lot of fun to actually play the characters. And, you know, like I said, I've not been into RPGs much over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, but this is
so lightweight RPG.
It's RPG light, if anything.
It is. It's light with L-I-T-E, RPG light. It's and so that's very nice. It essentially accounts for the fact that I'll have my guys do little quips and quotes anyway, even on a regular, strategic board game. So now I can do quips and quotes, and they're actually put on a little counter, of a little man, rather than
It's terrible. When I play chess against Nathan, he acts out the death throes of each piece.
That's right.
No, he does not. I'm just joking. But
all the pawns, take this knight. Yeah, I do stuff like that. And so.
But so we've had a lot of fun with this, and it's a great framework. There's a lot of things you can do with it, and if you look on, there's a Yahoo group for this, which has a fairly active mailing list. I'll post a link to that in the show notes. There's
the game designer is actually on that list, and he contributes regularly to it.
They're two game designers, actually, two brothers. I don't want to say their names because I'll forget what it is. But they both contribute regularly to the list, so any rules questions you have, you can ask. And they pretty promptly answer, and lots of people have posted all kinds of expansions for this, extra ships, and it's just a really great framework that you can use for all kinds of things. So that's Battle Stations.
Yeah, and if you don't take our word for it, I was just listening to the Dice Tower, and they reviewed it in their episode number 16, I believe, so you can hear what their opinion is of it well. But, we hope you'll listen to our opinion of it, and that it's a great game and worth playing.
I think they just did listen to our opinion of it. You heard it, you can't unhear it. So that's another episode of Roll 2D6. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2D6 times 2 days.
And may all of your close quarter alien combat resolve in your favor until then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.